Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 30th, 2004. Today's session number is POM 2004-03. Today's speaker is Michael Pellet. The lesson for today is Summoned Out to be Human. Don't just read this, do something. Let's listen in.
For some folks, they might discern that already at 20, and others it might take 50.
Maybe the reason I ask that is because I know too many people from my generation who went into the ministry because it was the family's agenda or something along that line. Actually, he had a gift for some parts of the ministry, but he didn't really, I'm sure it wouldn't have been his first choice. He wrote the great song.
Good morning. We'll say burn it, Bob, so they start the recording so that every thought and action that we have will be noted for posterity. My name is Michael Pellet, and this is the last of three sessions that I've done this week on the theme, and the theme, Summon Out What We Shall Be. And I've taken a very, very broad slice of it, looking at what it is to be human. And I've also tried to look at that in kind of three different media. The first one on Monday was through looking at paintings, and paintings that talk about human call, being called out. And last night, if you were here, we tried to look at it through drama or literature, a biblical story, Genesis chapters 2 and 3, and to note that our first sense of calling out as human beings is that we were called out by the serpent. We were actually called out or summoned to be evil. And why did we succumb to that? So we looked at that. Today what I want to do, again, a very ambitious project, looking at about 2,500 years of Western philosophy, and looking at the notion of how we are summoned out to be human, how we are called out by what we do through our actions. That, of course, you can think about that. It's a very commonplace understanding that you come to Holden, you sit at the table with someone, you want to get to know who someone is, and so you go through the standard procedures, you know, hello, who are you, where are you from, and usually second or something is, what do you do? So somehow, whatever it is that you do, whatever it is that we do, talks about who or what we are and what it is to be human. And the thing here is that if you look at this from the history of Western theology and philosophy, what it is that we do and the values that are there have changed. And so what I want to do today is trace a little bit that shift in values, and in that sense, almost a redefining and re-understanding of what it is as human, the human condition, particularly what it is to be a valuable human being. And look at that, and we won't get through it all, I know that already, but particularly to function on the life of action, and I will want to function on particularly here these two notions of labor and work. So let me give you a little outline here in terms of Western theology and philosophy. And over here in this column, to look at this in terms of if you were living at the times of Plato, Aristotle, Jesus, Paul, Luther, it would all be the same, right up until about our modern era. Let's just for round numbers say, after the Reformation, 1650, 1700, things significantly changed. But until then, this would be the hierarchy of how you would look at values and in terms of what you do. And there were two major sections, the life of contemplation and the life of action. And that life of contemplation basically had three realms of contemplation or thought. The highest realm that you could have, both within philosophy and theology or Christianity or other religion, would be that realm of theology. Contemplating and thinking about the divine. It would be like the mystical tradition within Christianity. But if you will, even the Greeks had their mystics. And in many respects, if you've studied any classic philosophy and read Plato's Apology and the life of Socrates, you can see Socrates as well as a philosopher. You could put Socrates up here in that realm of theology because Socrates always talks about how he hears the voice of the divine. And his voice tells him what to do. And at times he would be so transfixed by that voice, he would like just stay standing out all night in a field, transfixed, thinking great thoughts. And at least when I'm transfixed, I like to think I think great thoughts. Usually I'm just paralyzed. But anyway, right? That's theology. Of course, right beneath that is philosophy. And that's what the philosophers too were to do. Think great thoughts. Try to pursue the deepest and most profound questions. What does it mean to be? Why is there something rather than nothing?
Wow,
and that's a great question. I just love that. And beneath that, but still in this realm of contemplation, is the realm of science. And science here, more from its Latin root, scientia, is the way of knowing. And in the life of contemplation, the way of knowing would always be trying to know the universals. And so in particular, this is the realm of mathematics and logic. In terms of science and mathematics, you can think of someone like Pythagoras and the Pythagorean theorem, that in a right-angle triangle, right, the square of the hypotenuse equals the square of the two sides. You know, he thought that up, supposedly. Or you can think of Euclid and Euclidean geometry. That would be that kind of mathematics that's there. And mathematics was tremendously important back then because you would think those things. No calculators, no computers. You had to think about it. And of course, the other way of thinking is logic. Because again, logic too would always look at whether or not an argument is valid. And the interesting thing there is, and this is where the scientists and philosophers could sometimes clash, because just because something is valid doesn't mean it's true. Just because it's valid doesn't mean it's true. Yeah, see? Something to think about.
What would be an example of that?
An example of that is that I could give you a perfectly valid logical syllogism, but it wouldn't be true.
Well, that helps.
Right? That doesn't help. All right, okay. So, right, we can say something like, well, how controversial do you want to be? Right, all men are smarter than women. Alex is a man. Therefore, Alex is smarter than all women. That's a valid statement. Is it true? And I'll let you answer that.
But is it a valid statement, though? That's the question, isn't it?
Yes, because the logic follows from a universal premise to a more particular premise. You have a middle term that works, and so you can make that conclusion. So it is valid, but it's not true. At least I would say it's not true. Right. But that's, and I mean, that's the kind of thing, if you will, that happens all the time within editorials, or again within the life of community. These are the kind of things that was called the group of people that folks like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle were opposed to, the sophists. What the sophists did is they taught you how to argue and how to win an argument, even though it wouldn't be true. Today we call them spin doctors.
Politicians too, though.
Right? Well, politicians too.
Or lawyers.
Let's just dump them all. But it is that kind of thing where you can use valid arguments, but they're not true. And so you need to think those things through, right? Think about them. That's that first category. Under the life of contemplation comes the life of action. And action, again, is divided into three particular kinds of action. What would be called action proper, and that would be the realm of politics, ethics, and interestingly enough, friendship. Friendship is an action. Friendship is something that you have to work at, if you will. And it involves that kind of human engagement and human energy to form a friendship. And again, if you would be a philosopher like Aristotle, he would note that there are three kinds of friendship. There is useful friendship, which we would call kind of like business acquaintances, you know. Well, I know a guy who knows a guy where you can get this wholesale. There's friendship for pleasure, which Aristotle says is predominant among the youth. And what he means by that is dating and all those raging hormones that are going on in those ages and folks who are friends. And then there is genuine friendship. A genuine friendship is where the other person, your friend, is virtually yourself as other. That's how close those kinds of friendships are. They actually reflect your own self. And Aristotle says that everyone is particularly lucky and fortunate were they to have two or three friends of this type. Right? Very close friendship. It's that kind of friendship, philia would be the Greek term, that we see, I think, at work in John's Gospel, where Jesus says to his disciples there, I have called you friends. Or no greater love has anyone than that they would lay down their life for their friends. Right, now, what kind of friend is that? I would say that for Greek people in the world back then, they would understand it to be this genuine kind of friendship. And that the metaphor there is that in Christ, we are all that kind of friend to one another. A tremendously profound statement at that point. Next in line is the action that is called work. In Latin, this is the notion that talks about human beings as homo faber, man or the human as fabricator, maker, manufacturer. Again, to try to define what that means, work is to be understood as to make whatever is needed to house the human body. It'd be things like use objects, artifacts, or this would be, again, what we would call world. In this way of thinking, the world is a human construct, distinct from, we can put in parenthesis here, nature. Nature is rocks, trees, grass, flowers. World is what we make. Houses, churches, buses, tools, machines. That's world. It's the human construct. And of course, it's what we as human beings use. The lowest thing here on this scale is labor. And again, in Latin, anima laborans. And anima means soul. So we're not, so it's what makes what we are in common with all animals. But this is in terms of souls. We are, at the lowest level of action, laboring souls. Laboring animate organisms, to put it that way. To try to give that a definition, it would mean to produce whatever is necessary to keep the human organism alive. And here, the technical term that they would use would be consumer goods. Now again, today we may waffle on that term and something like that, because for us, consumer goods seems to take up just about everything we can think of. But here I'd like to suggest that perhaps that tells us something. That if the basic way in which we think about ourselves is as consumers, and basically that's how we're asked to think about ourselves today, it also means that it places us down in this category, is that we're basically viewed upon and consider ourselves laboring souls. And that we seem to do everything within this realm of necessity. And so that's one of the things I want to think about. What would be here in this notion of to produce whatever is necessary, consumer goods? Well, the most obvious example of that is food. We consume food. And in this area of labor, labor are the kinds of things that you have to do again and again and again. We always have to keep eating so that there's that labor there. Or if we have to keep sleeping, then we always have to do, at least most mothers seem to educate us this way, like make your bed, which is, of course, a futile enterprise. And that's the whole thing, that with labor is connected the notion of futility. Because no matter what you do, it's going to be consumed, and you have to do it again. Holden can cook the best meal in the world. And you can eat the best meal in the world. But it's all futile. Because 4, 6, 8, 24 hours later, you're going to be hungry again. So it doesn't make any difference whether you had the best meal or just an okay meal. You're still going to be hungry. Cooking is futile. I know, that's it, right? But yeah, I'm sure you get the point, right? You have to do it again and again and again. That's why, one more thing here in this classic setup, the world of action also classified people and values. In this world of action, politics, ethics, and friendship, so on and so forth, and I'll use the Greek categories here, that was the realm of the citizen. That was the realm of the human being who would be considered free. As a free citizen, you could engage in action, in politics, ethics, friendship, so on and so forth. Work to be that human fabricator, that was the world of the artisan and the merchant. The cobbler, the carpenter, the person at the marketplace, so on and so forth. And the realm of labor, as you can probably anticipate by now, is the realm of the slave. Because it is the world of futility. It is the world of no freedom. Because you see, you can never be free of what's necessary to keep you alive. Even the emperor has to eat. But what makes the emperor free is that the emperor isn't the one who has to raise the food and cultivate the food and prepare the food. He just says, I'm hungry, and there it is. That's being free. Free from the necessities of life which burden you down. And so of course, that would mean that people in the realm of action, the citizen, would be truly human. And in these other realms of action would be less than human. The true and full human. And we can look at this as well and see, pretty easy to figure out how patriarchy fits in here. Think about women's suffrage, right? When women get the right to vote, that plunks them right up here in this whole realm. Do we want them? That's kind of risky.
Yeah, where are women? Women aren't.
In Aristotle's society, or in classic society, they're usually down here. because, as we all know, women's chief task is a notion of labor. Even if you are, let's say, a woman of a citizen, and so on and so forth, so that gives you some authority because you would be running the household. But what would keep you down here is your close connection to nature and the necessities of procreation, right? And it is, I think, not an accident to talk about when women give birth, they go into
labor.
Yeah, they don't go into work, they don't go into action, they go into labor. And interestingly enough, if you do, you do the word study, that's in Greek. This, the word for labor is birthing process. Same in Latin, same in Spanish, same in French, same in German, you can say the same in English. So that in that sense, these words and that birthing process already describe or label your place. I think it's very intentional.
I'm trying to overlay the hierarchy of the life of contemplation on the life of action. Does that work at all?
Not quite, because you see, you can have a life of action without contemplation, but you can't have a life of contemplation without action. In other words, right? You can be a slave and never think a great thought. But it's pretty hard to think a great thought and be starving, right? You still need to eat, to sleep, to have shelter, or whatever, in order to have the life of contemplation. So the life of contemplation is always dependent upon the life of action. And, of course, one of the things within the philosophical tradition would be to think through how dependent are those things. And, again, this is where we get into the notion of asceticism in terms of trying to say you can think more and better great thoughts if you can get as much of this behind you and out of the way as you can. Right, so that somehow the discipline of thinking, the discipline of mysticism, would be to try to leave this life of action as far behind and come up and contemplate.
Thank you.
And in some senses, that's precisely that's what holiness is about for many folks, right? You leave your quote-unquote, workaday world behind, so you can come up here and contemplate, or have a sense of renewal or refreshment. And what's great about that is there is somebody else here who does do the cooking.
Yes.
And all of that kind of stuff. So that you can, you know, most of you going down on the bus, better have thought a great thought.
That would be the privilege of the Brahmin caste, right, in Hinduism, is that you're freed from the workaday things and you're at that elevated level where you can spend most of your time in contemplation.
Sure. All the various cultures and whatnot have their own particular ways in which things that suggest here is how one can achieve a life of contemplation.
And yet there are monastic orders that say you need to combine those two, the work, even the labor, and the contemplation.
Right, right. The ora et labor, prayer and labor, and action, and do that together. And that's right. There are, in other words, it's not only the ascetic tradition that says you can do that. I mean, it can be various monastic orders, or one would say Luther, for example, would try to combine these as well. And his sense of vocation is precisely the way in which one worships God, contemplates God, is through the living of one's vocation. That's a different way of looking at things, but it's still trying to grapple with that. And, you know, and again, often when Luther talks about it, he likes to use examples like the milkmaid and the stable boy, right? Because that would really jar anyone in this realm to say, here's the stable boy mucking out the stables, which is praising and glorifying God. And so you got to think, okay, now how does shoveling manure equal with thinking great thoughts? But that's Luther.
And just if I could put that in the context of Holden and our mission, the full phrase that was coined by Carol Hinderman, the founding director, was a place apart to be a part. And I think that that full phrase is better used to describe, you know, this action of up the road and back down the road in terms of where our mission is ultimately directed.
Okay, what a wonderful picture. But now it's all turned upside down. And it was turned upside down, and I'm going to look at or blame, if you will, three people. There are more, but these folks are tremendously influential in this. Again, economists and philosophers who you may or may not have heard of. Adam Smith, John Locke, and Karl Marx. And all of these folks had economic, political understandings, and their primary concern was dealing with what it is to be human, but looking at that with regard to the human being's relationship to nature in terms of labor and the world around them and what that would mean. And so when that happened, whether it's Adam Smith or a century later or so Karl Marx, what became the highest value for all three of these thinkers and other folks today is productive labor. In other words, this whole realm was basically struck out as unimportant or secondary. So if you look at Adam Smith's classic book is The Wealth of Nations, if you go through there, read some of the footnotes, he'll give you his hierarchy of who are the most valuable and important people. And they are the ones who engage in productive labor. So for example, he thinks farmers are very important. Of course, farmers would have come pretty low on this scale. People who are not important for Adam Smith, and this hits pretty hard for me, are university professors, lawyers, and clergy, because they do nothing productive. Right? And you think about that, I mean, I think at least my experiences are, and Lydia was talking about this earlier, I think one of the things in our day and age is clergy have a real identity crisis, precisely because they're not looked upon as doing anything very productive. Right? A minister of word and sacraments, what good does that do anybody? Or you can get any fool up there, read out of the book, and then move on. Right? So now you have to think, I've got to be a productive member of society. And that whole thing about productive labor. We can see that working in all sorts of other ways. I mean, why is retirement a crisis for so many people? Well, because when you're, because up until, right, pick your number, 60, 62, 63, 65, 70, you were a productive member of society. And then on your 65th birthday, you became a leech. Your productivity stopped.
A long time.
So what good are you? Right? That's the kind of thing. Or the kind of interesting thing about what people do with their leisure time. That kind of irony and paradox. We work harder and harder to have more leisure time. But what do we want to do in our leisure time? Do we really want to have leisure? Well, no, of course not. Because that would mean you're worthless. So in your leisure time, you have to do things like volunteer so that you do stop. Like, hold it. No, you don't have to like what I say, but it's true.
Two things. I read not too long ago that the average length of your life after you retire for men is 8 months. They just die because they don't have anything to do. And when we moved to West Virginia and the people came over to our farm and said to John, what do you do? And he said, I'm a pastor. And they said, no, I mean, what is your work? Well, how do you work? What do you do? It was not, I mean.
Yeah, precise. I mean, like, don't you do something? That whole sense. And we all, now live under this kind of pressure. This, I would contend, is the highest value that we hold to in our society today. Productive labor. I mean, think about that. I mean, let's just pick Socrates because Socrates certainly did not do any productive labor. He just goes around asking people questions. And then finally gets them so infuriated they decide it's necessary to kill him. Right? But he wasn't productive labor. I mean, one may want to ask the kind of question, what about Jesus? He's a carpenter, but he just kind of does that on the side for a little bit, right? I mean, most of the time he does, useless things like trotting around the Galilee talking a lot.
Well, women for a long time were housewives, and that was pretty productive, but it certainly nowadays isn't recognized. You are embarrassed if that's all you say you are, is just a housewife or just a homemaker. You need a career.
Yes. And there, in terms of this kind of vocabulary and putting it in here, the difficulty with being, again, that thing, you're just a housewife. Because, you see, it wouldn't be considered productive. You're here in the realm of futility. Housewives are doing what? They're always cleaning up after husbands, the kids. They're making the beds. They're vacuuming. They're cooking. But you see, none of that is considered truly productive. Yeah. If you're productive, you make something. Like cars. Right? And so that in that sense, people who, if you will, labor very, very hard receive absolutely no credit for what they do because it's not considered productive. There was another hand.
It's also, if I meet another woman, I'm very careful to say, and do you work outside the home? As if that gives them more validity or something. which is, I mean, I don't know why we put that on one another, but that, that's what I do, I confess that.
Put it on one another because Adam Smith said so.
Yeah, well, that's right, Adam Smith and John Locke. And
yeah.
I mean, here again, the reason I choose Adam Smith or Karl Marx is it doesn't make any difference if you're a right-leaning conservative or a left-leaning socialist. Smith and Marx, when it comes to this kind of valuation, absolutely agree. What counts is productive labor. And it doesn't, you know, you can be in, the United States or the former Soviet Union, and that value of productive labor would still be the key value. Let me read a few things, just a few very brief phrases from Karl Marx, because he's the one who talks about these things. Here's the way in which Marx defines labor. Labor is, quote unquote, the metabolism between humans and nature. The metabolism between humans and nature. Or again, Marx says that we have to labor because labor is, quote unquote, the eternal necessity imposed by nature. And so that in Marx, if you read Das Kapital, the true goal of what Marx is after is the emancipation of the human being from labor, of which the emancipation of the working classes is the first step. Because again, for Marx, in his, if you will, more utopian view, the classless society would finally be that society which is freed from labor. The way in which Marx says it. One more quotation from him, and then we're done with that. Marx says, quote unquote, "The realm of freedom begins only where labor, determined through want and the immediacy of physical needs, ends." The realm of freedom begins only where labor, determined through want and the immediacy of physical needs, ends. And so that what becomes key here is that the true emancipation of human beings from labor, to get you out of this realm of labor that's stuck in nature and all of that, what is truly going to free you up is not a political revolution, but what? Any guesses? Who is our liberator? What is our liberator?
John Locke.
Technology. Right? What frees us from labor, from this necessity, is technology. Because if we can get, you know, crassly put, if we can get a machine to do it, then we don't have to. And then we are freed from the immediacy of those needs.
So how did he handle the procreative necessity?
Well, in his day and time, when he was still writing and thinking, procreation was still, if you will, natural, and so he didn't discuss that.
He didn't need to. Okay.
But you can see why he's so concerned with the working classes, and particularly laborers, day laborers, because they're pretty much bound within this realm of necessity. And how do you free them? Through technology.
How did he propose to handle the paycheck?
In terms of?
How we buy the things that this wonderful technology provides so that we can satisfy those basic needs.
Well, his sense of that is where the state apparatus handles and takes care of that. Right. That's the socialist side of Marx. But again, I think, and again, particularly because of all the politics and ideology that surround it, we look at Marx and we see all that socialist side of him. But I'd suggest a careful reading. The big goal of Marx is emancipation from labor, and the way in which we're going to do that is through technology. Right? Technology is what can provide human beings with freedom.
But it's a trick.
Mm-hmm. It's a trick.
It's a trick.
And why is it a trick?
Technology has not freed us. It has made us worse slaves in many areas.
Did I misunderstand, or didn't Marx say that freedom is only when we're free, when we get to the point where we've satisfied our basic need is where freedom comes, mm-hmm. and quit the working at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we're striving for more than beyond the basic needs.
Yes, we want to strive for more, but how can we free ourselves from that? We need technology to do that.
For the bonuses.
Freedom. I mean, with this technology, if you will, technology and his word for this. Emancipation. Technology emancipates us from labor.
So the microwave oven.
Yeah.
So, I'm a little confused because wasn't our greatest value productive labor?
Yes.
So we're emancipating ourselves from what we value the most, or?
No, because you see, productive labor is not being bound to these things that are necessity. Because necessities are never productive. Because you consume them and you keep needing them again and again and again. So what you need to do is be freed from labor and all of that so that you can do things that are productive and engage in productive labor.
Are these philosophers the reason that men were more highly esteemed because they were doing, in essence, what that defined as true labor? And women were caring and nurturing for babies and children and bearing them, and that was just necessity. Is this one of the reasons, perhaps, that men were more highly esteemed?
Yes, right. Because, again, the whole role of women, right back to senses of procreation, was always understood to be totally within the realm of labor. And therefore, it was necessity and not truly considered productive, valued.
And I can see under this, too, a disdain for nature and for creation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because what you want to do is to pull away from that necessity.
Exactly.
Yes. Precisely. And so, and here, and this is also the transition from labor into work. And we'll see, and let me move there again, just because of our time here, that in this movement from labor into work, what one does then is basically transform nature. Right? Because, again, what becomes the key understanding of how something is productive in everything in our world, the key here is this notion of use. And that's why, again, I want to make the distinction between nature and world. To use one example, right? What good is a tree? It just sits there
and takes up space.
Right.
But if I cut that tree down and mill it into lumber, now it's beginning to be something useful. And if I take that lumber and turn it into a table, a use object, now I've done something productive. And so the basic understanding of work, of making something, to make whatever is needed to house the human body at its most basic level, involves the transformation of nature. Because here, in this realm of work, the big word, the big value here, utilitarianism, utility, usefulness, right? Nature as nature, by and large, is useless. So we have to do something with it. And that's Homo Faber. Human beings as maker and manufacturer transform nature.
So as a nurse and an educator, I am never more than a laborer?
Yes, that's correct. In this setup, you're basically a laborer. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, for Adam Smith, so are physicians. Now, what happens there, what might happen for a nurse as well, is that people begin to recognize that what you can do is, well, physicians, nurses could be more than labor. They could become useful if what they do is keep all sorts of other people healthy so they can be good laborers. So now, all of a sudden, one might want to make an argument that you're useful. But you got to keep people healthy. Because if you don't keep...
And you got to save their lives.
Huh? Well, yeah, saving life is one way to keep us healthy. That's so as long as you can keep us healthy, you're useful.
But you see, I'm a mental health nurse.
Uh-oh.
But if you're an educator, then you're training people for the future to be useful.
That's right.
And if you're a mother, you do the same thing.
And if you're a mother, you do the same thing.
But the thing here is note your operative word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And make that distinction there.
Training.
There, I think, you know, again, to just use our vocabulary precise, there's a difference between training and educating. And the sense about training is precisely teaching skills to make people useful. Not necessarily helping them how to think, but to be useful.
So my wife, whose father closely followed Adam Smith, when she wanted to be an English major, he said, I won't pay for your college unless you do something in a vocation so you can go to journalism because you will learn a trade.
Precisely. Do something useful.
So artists and musicians and story writers are not useful and we don't value them and they never get paid what they're
worth. That's right. Exactly. Let me point out to you, this is obviously not what Christian Gilley is the most useless person in this village. She's the village artist. There is nothing more useless than works of art. Unless you use them to hide a hole in your wall. Other than that, I mean, when we're talking about productive labor, the village artist is absolutely useless. And think in our society today, too, right? Do we value artists, musicians, and all? I mean, it's always hard to keep, quote-unquote, culture alive. Because they're kind of, you know...
Unless they slide into a consumer good.
Unless they make it consumer goods, or now the interesting thing is that we know collecting art can be very useful because, you know, if you happen to have a Picasso, and now you can sell it for $80 million, now it's all of a sudden worth something, but certainly not as art. We'll go here and then over there.
Is this already an obsolete worldview? Because of what, I mean, we know it's not a very healthy worldview, but we are now in the service economy, and the number of people that are actually spending their time on the production of useful objects is smaller and smaller and smaller. So I guess my question is, isn't this why we're in such a chaos? Because this is an obsolete worldview.
It's an information society instead of an industrial.
Partly, as we're making the shift, as our technology shifts us from that kind of industrial to information and all of that, I would say the paradigm still holds, and what we're really working at with great difficulty at times is trying to justify why service industry or information industry is now useful. Because you see, if we can't say it's useful, then we discredit it. Or it's the kind of thing, still the case, why is it so many people who are in the service industry are also at the lower end of the pay scale?
Do you see a evolving new paradigm at all? Are there new thinkers like Adam Smith, John Locke, Karl Marx that, and I'm not saying that I think that I agree with their perspective, that's why we're in the fix we are as human beings, but I'm just curious because I think, I would say this is an obsolete worldview.
I don't think it's obsolete at all. I mean, I think it is still the dominant worldview.
No, but I'm saying it doesn't fit. It's going to get to be more and more. When I say obsolete, I mean it isn't. It's going to get less and less useful, I think.
We'll go back there and then next to me, please.
Back to the trees. What about the scientific thought that in the long run we need plants and trees to live, to stay alive? The air we breathe. I mean, is that back in the contemplative?
No, that's again kind of recognizing that indeed trees might be useful and we need them, but you know.
But you have to be a thinker.
It'd be far better if we could find the kind of technology that would do the same thing so we wouldn't have to mess around with all those tall green things. Or, you know. Trees might be helpful, but after all, as George Bush would say, if it really is going to hurt the economy, we just have to forget Kyoto and all that.
But where would Marx have put scientists who give us that information? Would he have allowed them the kind
applied
of
applied science is very important. Okay. Right, rather than just theoretical. We'll go back behind that.
I can see even in a service economy, if you're using a utilitarian basis here, then you're still saying, well, how many people have we served? And that's the criteria.
Oh, yeah.
And that underneath all of this, there's no spirit. There's no spirit in us. That's what's lacking.
Well, it's the human connection.
Right. That's the realm of action, you know. But it's the kind of thing, you think about that, And again, one of the things that Holden holds up, you know, if you ask, are there alternatives? I mean, the whole thing is, in this whole realm of productive labor, the realm of action, too, isn't that important in terms of think about community. Who needs community? You know, we talk, you know, we use the word community all the time, but our neighborhoods are never community. To be community, you have to be intentional. Holden tries to be community. However, a little critical jab here, they're also pretty much involved in this world of work as well. And you say, well, that's necessary and useful, and yeah, but right, that's always the tension. I'll just leave it. Alex.
I'm amazed at how much this paradigm has permeated the culture of the congregation and faith systems. How much emphasis was placed on these things within a congregational setting, within the context of worship, how much worship becomes work rather than contemplative, how much a church's ministry becomes programmatic rather than a lot of the other things, and how mega churches are preferred over other sorts of faith expressions. I mean, this has permeated worship, ministry, all kinds of things in some destructive ways, it seems mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm.
Very much so. A number of years ago, I might have even given a presentation here. I wrote an article, it's called Ecclesial Darwinism and the Collapse of Koinonia. this whole stuff, right, it's precisely church growth, I mean, if you will, church growth development models and mega church have bought into this hook, line, and sinker. And what have we lost? Community. Yes, please.
Wonder capitalism isn't useful, primarily measured by profitability.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And that kind of goes along with churches are often have to look at profitability in the bottom line.
Yes. Oh, that's one of the most useful things about stuff that we make. It has exchange value. So, in other words, if I can make a widget that everybody wants and desires and it's useful for them, and I can do lots of those things, I make big bucks. Right?
So the $25 million baseball player doesn't really produce anything except under capitalism. There's the profitability factor.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's, again, the kind of thing Adam Smith, he would think we're just nuts paying athletes the salaries we do.
We are.
Well, except that the owners get their $25 million.
They are useful for some of the owners.
Even in what we consider service professions, like in hospitals, they talk in terms of what is revenue producing and what is not revenue producing. So X-ray technician does an X-ray, that's revenue producing, so that's more valuable. But a social worker may not be valuable because there's not directly revenue produced from that task.
And they're the first to go.
And they're the first to go when you're downsizing. And I think that the church has kind of bought into that corporate kind of thinking about what is productive.
So have most of our, the educational institution at my university, it's the same thing. By and large, the big thing there is every department must be quote unquote cost effective. In other words, you better get enough students in there paying tuition, whatnot, blah, 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 so that, if you will, you make a profit, or at least break even, or else, who needs you?
Yeah, Tim, I'm going to let you know. In this day, if you're not from
Washington. What was John Locke's contribution to this?
John Locke's contribution to all of this is also talking in terms of what's valuable. And for his notion, he too understands that productive labor, and that is what counts as the true value of things. So they're all linked together here about putting value in terms of this kind of notion of productivity.
For those of us leaving after lunch here, it looks to me like you're moving towards the value of action.
Would you like to?
Can you give a quick synopsis of where you'd be taking us?
Well, the value of action, I'm leaving after lunch too, so this is all you get. But the value of action, again, is in terms of this area, in terms of action, and probably the key thing about action is, one could say, speech and action. It is through our speech and action that we let others know who we truly are. And so the kind of criticism here is that the contemporary model of this productive labor and everything is, I would contend, a dehumanizing model, because we never get at what it truly is to be human. Who we are as human beings comes through our speech and action, where we participate in communities, deliberate about what is the good, and again, engage in friendship, right? It's organizing, living together. And it's that interesting thing, I think, about human beings, all the way back again to Genesis 2. It is not good for Adam, the man, for human being, to be alone. It's in living together, it's in community, that we begin individually to understand who we are, and therefore as well what it is to be human. And we basically eclipse that in our way of going about things. In fact, what has happened, my last comment, and then we'll stop, is that within the last century, two centuries, human beings have looked at one another as use objects. All of you philosophers, if you remember Immanuel Kant and the categorical imperative, was that it is impermissible to treat human beings as means, but only as ends. In other words, a human being was an end in itself. In other words, an intrinsic good. You're good just because you're human. And to treat you as simply a use object, Kant would say, is the height of immorality. His whole ethics is based on that. But of course, today, right, we are the user society. And what do we do with human beings? How many humans do we understand as a good in themselves, a good in itself, an end in itself? We simply see human beings as, and think of phrases like, well, you know, I'm just one little cog in the machine. Well, you're a use object. And that, again, is the dehumanizing tendency we're in, isn't it? We simply think it is okay to use people. Just like we use a machine, just like we use a table. And therefore, that's their only value. And there again is where I would say the gospel, the church, has to model a different way of being together. And as some of you have said, and I could go on long rants too, I think the megachurch model is absolutely devastating to what who we are called to be and what we are called to do. But I'll just say that.
Who are the prophets speaking then to us?
Who are the prophets speaking that we need to think about things differently and all of that?
A great turning away.
Well, for me, and I put it in the little blurb, I think the one who's got a really great handle on all of this is Hannah Arendt. And her book, and again, it's heavy going philosophy. It's not easy. But her book that talks about so much of this stuff is called The Human Condition. And she talks about what happens with the eclipse of action and all of that. Tremendously influential political thinker in North America and Europe. Folks like Vaclav Havel, for example, said that, you know, what encouraged him to go on and do what he needed to do for freedom in the Czech Republic and so on and so forth were through the things he read in Hannah Arendt. Many Eastern European thinkers, philosophers, see her as the key person, as well as in Europe and North America. So to just give one name of someone who I think really is trying to think differently about that, that would be the person I'd suggest.
Just to throw a friendly wrench into your comments on megachurches, there are megachurches where small groups are very much key, and where the philosophy is everyone is connected and no one stands alone.
Yes, but it's the small group. The issue is, what's the relationship between small group and community? And is still the overall paradigm. And the reason we try to get as many small groups as possible to meet your needs, the usefulness that's there. But your comment is good in terms of the sense they recognize that just the big organization like that doesn't do it all. But finally, to have any sense of action, community, any kind of humanization happening, you need the small group.
I just want to support her comment, because I spent my professional life working from the small group point of view, teaching in schools of business and so on, the very things that really put this, that's where we were at. The groups have emerged as a viable, useful thing to understand in what we've been talking about here. And that's happened about in the last 20 years. 20 years ago, when I was teaching this stuff, if you said group, people said, you're some kind of weirdo. You know, we don't want to mess around with groups. That's just those things that take a lot of time to get any decisions made. No more today. Now, teamwork is the big deal. So
we'll go upstairs to David, and then down here will be the last comment.
About 2 months ago, I read the JCPenney store, their founding principles. From, I don't know, I'm guessing 100 years ago or whenever JCPenney was founded. And one of the principles was, we exist to make a profit, but not so much profit as the market will bear. Only enough to serve, so that we may serve the common good. Then I think of a corporation like the Enron, you know, and when we hear about that, and you know, what can we get? And I'm wondering, was the JCPenney model, is that part of the Adam Smith model with the common good? Does he talk about the common good? Or is that a different model entirely?
No, the JCPenney would fit with Adam Smith. And again, you see, progressively what has happened, I mean, if you want to take JCPenney to Enron, you see what's happened. Profit has gained more and more strength. The common good is being totally eclipsed or diminished.
You see, the idea that profit is the common good. Is that it? Or?
Practically, right, because that's the only thing that's useful. That's what your shareholders want to hear. How much money in it for us?
And that would be something that Adam Smith would not have been surprised at.
He would have been surprised at that. He would consider that, I think, to be fair to him, a misunderstanding of what he was about. Because he still thought productive labor would be for the common good.
Well, thinking of the need and advantages of small groups and small churches compared to mega churches, it seems like there is a movement now in that direction. And in our town, it seems like there are a lot of small mom-and-pop businesses that are closing their doors. And it's amazing how many of those buildings then are taken over by new small churches. So I see that as a movement.
Yeah, I've read a book recently that talks about how the house church is on the rise. Small Christian community.
Would you just cite that article you made on the